KBO News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been called America's shame, the fact that more than 12,000 children died from abuse and neglect between the years of 2001 and 2008. And while individually these tragedies do make headlines and horrify us, the broader, deeper story isn't being told. What led to this abuse and how it might have been prevented. Now, though many national groups concerned with child welfare are trying to change that, they're highlighting the huge holes they see in our child protection systems, from caseworkers who oversee far too many families to the lack of mental health treatment for overstressed parents. But they're not just talking about services and programs. They're also tackling the societal discomfort many people feel when confronted with this issue. Neighbors, friends, relatives who suspect trouble and want to help, but don't feel right judging or meddling in family matters. Today in The Exchange, chilling numbers on child abuse and neglect fatalities, why the numbers are up, and why a recent study ranks the U.S. so poorly compared to other industrialized nations. We begin with Michael Petit. He's president of Every Child Matters and author of the report I mentioned. It's called We Can Do Better, Child Abuse Deaths in America. And Michael Petit, thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, and thank you for having me.
Well, this study comparing the U.S. to other nations, Michael, really caught our eye. What did you find when you looked at child maltreatment deaths across the industrialized world?
Well, from what we can tell, according to different reports, the rate of fatalities in the United States is at least double that of most other countries. And in some cases, compared with Italy's, for example, it's reported as being 11 times greater than Italy. So we seem to have a much more widespread problem, and I think it stems from the fact that in large part we have a much larger number of poor people and other troubled individuals in many of these other countries.
Well, and how confident are you that you're measuring apples to apples here? I mean, I've heard that it's even hard to compare state to state. What about country to country?
Well, I think it is hard to do, and I don't think it's one that we've seen the last word on yet. But so far, all of the major studies on overall child well-being, including child protection issues, keep tipping in the same direction. That is, that among the rich industrialized countries, the United States is somewhere near the bottom. And a recent report that was featured in last Saturday's New York Times had the U.S. Somewhere around 30th out of 33 or 34 rich democracies in overall child well-being, of which child abuse deaths is one extreme manifestation of that.
Well, and again, the deaths that you report on are absolutely shocking, and you highlight some of the individuals, and it breaks your heart. I wonder, you talk a lot about, you know, the child welfare system and how it's under stress and strain. What about law enforcement, Michael? After all, abusing a child and killing a child is certainly a crime.
Well, you know, let's be clear that everyone agrees that we should prevent child abuse in the first place. And there are many things that we know about on how to prevent child abuse and how to promote healthy human growth and development. And the fact is, with regards to the numbers, the undercount in the United States is very, very significant. The official total is 1,800 a year. The real number is at least 2,500 a year, according to several studies, and it might be as high as 3,000 or 4,000. With respect to law enforcement, the vast majority of child abuse cases can be dealt with through a public health model that is emphasized as home visitors, delaying the onset of the first pregnancy, helping families to manage their affairs when they need it, dealing with substance abuse issues and so forth. The vast majority can be dealt with that way. There's another group that need the formal child protection system and all that is associated with intervening in those cases. But there's a final classification of children where the risk of death may be imminent. It's a very serious situation. There's a history of child abuse. It may be an unrelated male in the household, which is significant because they're 1,500 times more likely to be in a household where a child is killed than where there's a related male. In certain cases, social workers are not enough to deal with a child's mortality looking at him. And those are cases where, in the best jurisdictions, there's a high degree of coordination between law enforcement, prosecutors, courts, and child protective services, in which the goal is first to prevent the child from being injured.
Well, and Michael, thank you so much for joining us this hour. And we will be chewing on these numbers all hour with our guests. But thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Michael Petit, president of Every Child Matters and author of the report, We Can Do Better, Child Abuse Deaths in America. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at this tragedy of child deaths from abuse and neglect and new efforts to raise awareness of what's behind these numbers. Let's hear from you. Why do you think America continues to see these statistics on children dying from abuse and neglect? What's one step do you think we could take to better protect our children? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests who've been looking at this issue for a long time. Joining us from Durham is Professor David Finkelhor, Director of the Crimes Against Children Research Center at UNH, co-director of the Family Research Laboratory, and a professor of sociology. And David, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Nice to be here.
Also with us in studio is Jim Mirovich, President and CEO of Prevent Child Abuse America, a national organization promoting awareness of this issue. And as part of that awareness campaign, he's in New Hampshire this week. And Jim, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for your time as well.
Happy to be here.
Well, and Jim, what's your reaction to these numbers comparing the U.S. to other countries? It's pretty shocking.
Well, you know, as I was listening to Michael, I was starting to think, even the comparison doesn't do anything for me. The fact that so many children die, I don't think we need that kind of comparison even, because it's so horrible. I think it's a tragedy that children don't have an opportunity to grow up and reach their full potential, and I think it's every one of our responsibilities to do something about it.
And you've said, Jim, as a nation, we have not connected the dots on this issue. What do you mean by that?
Well, several things. I'll say it in two parts. The first one is there's a culture within the United States that basically says you leave kids, the kids of a family alone. You don't intervene. You said it very well in your opening remarks. It's what we call the family bubble. That family is protected against the types of interactions that probably would help save children's lives at some point. The second thing is we haven't done a good job of putting all the research we have and evidence in place into practice. There is, and Dr. Finkelhor, I'm sure, will address this too, that there is so much research that indicates that when a child is abused or neglected, that there are serious health consequences sometimes, often into adulthood, mental health issues, drug dependency issues, delinquency, criminogenic behavior, on and on. We haven't connected the dots to show that wouldn't it be better to prevent the abuse and neglect from ever occurring in the first place?
So we're all looking at these problems as in silos. You know, here's delinquency in one silo. Here's drug use in another silo. You know, here's mental health issues in another silo. And you're saying it all starts early and it all starts in the home.
It absolutely does. I mean, I think we're all probably in a concurrence that the younger the child, the higher the rate of the victimization. So what are we going to do about it?
Well, and Michael Petit's numbers show that the vast majority of these victims are under one, which just absolutely breaks my heart. I want to bring you into this too, David. What do you think? Jim says, look, we know all this stuff, but we're not connecting the dots. What do you think?
Well, I wanted to expand on what Michael said, because there are two other pretty shocking facts that he didn't mention. One is the United States has a high homicide rate in general, but we have brought that rate down 50% over the last 20 years. During that time, the child maltreatment fatality rate for children has not improved. So we've been able to make progress on the general homicide problem, but on the child fatality issue, we have not. The second really shocking thing is that somewhere between a third and a half of the kids who die at the hands of caregivers are already known to the child welfare system. So these are kids who we have the potential to help, who we should have helped, but we're failing them. These aren't kids who just show up for the first time dead. And it is an additionally shocking fact.
Well, and those are two things definitely worth talking about. So let's hit them right on the head then, David. I mean, you said the U.S. has a high homicide rate, but it has gone down 50% in the last 20 years, I think you said. But the child fatality rate, again, at the hands of caregivers has not gone down. What do you think? Why is that?
Well, it is a particularly difficult segment of the population to deal with. Interestingly, child physical abuse has gone down, so we're reducing abuse in some of the population where it may be easier to kind of reach the problem. But this particular core of families with a lot of problems with alcohol drug abuse, with concentrated poverty and adversity, with unrealistic child rearing expectations or lack of knowledge, with children who are with economic stresses that they can't handle. We really have not done the kind of intensive interventions that are necessary to protect those children.
What do you think about that, Jim? I am shocked by that statistic that David gives us.
There's no question about it, and I think that there are some proven strategies that can overcome some of these things.
Such as?
Well, home visitation. I think the federal government did a nice job of putting together some resources so that new moms, pregnant moms and families and dads can receive home visitation services. Our listening tour has been very clear that the more we can educate and inform, not tell parents what to do, but to educate and inform parents so that they can make informed choices for their children, it turns out better for everybody.
You know what I'm really interested in terms of your background, Jim, is, as I understand, again, today you're president and CEO of Prevent Child Abuse America. You started out in corrections, didn't you?
I did.
Make that link for us.
I'd love to, because I can almost remember the year. It was 1988. Indiana's juvenile correctional facilities were under, like many states, a consent decree. And an advisor or a consultant from the National Council of Crime and Delinquency came into a briefing with the commissioner. And I was in the room, and he said, "Commissioner, do you know that 68% of your juveniles who are in your correctional facilities have been abused?" And I go, "Whoa." You know, and at the time, I really made no connection. It was a statistic without information. Unfortunately, as I moved through my careers, that statistic became a dot that I connected to other things in my career that I said, we've got to do things differently.
Wow. All right. Well, we will talk after a short break about how to do things differently. Also, David, I want to talk a little more about that other statistic you gave us, that a third to a half of children who die at the hands of caregivers are known to the child protection system. So we'll look at that. We'll also take your calls, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Keep it right here.
Support for New Hampshire Public Radio comes from you, our members, and New England College. Celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Master of Fine Arts and Poetry program, information on the winter residency at nec.edu. And from Holly Oil, a full-service oil company keeping New Hampshire families warm since 1961. Delivering bioheat to customers throughout Manchester and Concord, Holly Oil, HALLEOIL.com. New Hampshire weather for today, a mix of clouds and sunshine for most of the state, mostly cloudy in the North Country, highs 55 to 60 statewide. For tonight, partial clearing, lows from 35 to 40 for most of the state, near 30 in the North Country. For tomorrow, partly sunny and windy, highs in the 40s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, preventing child abuse and neglect in America. Let's hear from you. Why do you think America continues to see these horrifying statistics on children dying from abuse and neglect? What do you make of the report we looked at earlier showing that the U.S.'s fatality rate from abuse and neglect is much higher than other industrialized nations? And what's one step you think we could take to better protect children? Our number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And David Finkelhor and Jim Morovich, let's dive into that other number that, David, you gave us earlier. A third to a half of children who die at the hands of caregivers are known to child protection services. So what are we doing wrong there? Are we not stepping in early enough, or
well,
what?
There are people who think that we aren't aggressive enough in how we respond to children who we see in danger. And, of course, one of the things they would like to see is more children who are removed from families and placed in situations of safety. But that's very controversial, and there are other people who feel that that is that we already removed too many children, that children staying with their parents is important for their early development. And it's certainly a fact that in order to protect the children who are going to die, we're probably going to make mistakes and remove kids who don't need to be removed. So it's a very difficult public policy issue.
Well, who gets it right, David? I mean,
well, the truth is that we have programs that we know reduce child abuse in general, such as home visitation and parent education. We do not really know yet what reduces child maltreatment fatalities. We do not have any examples of programs that have been effective doing that. We have, for example, expanded our network of home visitation programs, but the child fatality rate hasn't come down. We can look and compare the United States with many of the countries that do better, and we can see some of the differences. But the differences are, there are large numbers of differences. There are differences in the social safety net. There are differences in the kind of economic supports that for poor families. There are differences in terms of the delivery of medical care and the availability of medical services to particularly challenged and poor families. There are more people in the there are more child care opportunities, but we don't know exactly which ones are the recipe for reducing the child maltreatment fatality problem.
Well, and I think it's important to ask, gentlemen, and Jim, I'll ask you first. You know, we've talked about the stress on poor families, and I have read that poverty is the single best predictor of child abuse. But, Jim, you know, this isn't just happening in the lowest income households. I mean, it happens across all socioeconomic groups, right?
That's exactly right, and the best way to respond to that is I was on a panel with the former director of child welfare for the state of Illinois. And a question had come up about has he seen a spike in child abuse and neglect in Illinois based upon the economic conditions? And his answer was poignant, cogent, and every other way on point. He simply said, you know, for the first time, people in the suburbs are starting to lose their home. Mm. People for the first time are losing their jobs. It's causing tremendous stress. And yes, there's a spike, and that spike is occurring in suburbia.
Well, and there was that story, Jim, in the New York Times about that prominent judge in Texas who, you know, was shown on videotape beating his teenage daughter and threatening her to, exactly. You know, beat her into submission, I think it was.
Exactly. Exactly. It reaches everywhere. There's no question about the link between poverty and certain maltreatment. But for us as a nation to believe that only poor people are involved in hurting children, that is just false. And we need to stop that perception or attitude.
Again, and David, I'm wondering how much substance abuse plays a role. It seems to play a role in so many problems. And certainly substance abuse is not just limited to, you know, low-income folks.
Well, that's true. But I have a somewhat different emphasis from Jim. I do think that poverty and economic and social disadvantage is a very big factor, particularly in the child abuse fatality part of the problem. One of the biggest contrasts is among states in the United States. So, for example, New Hampshire actually does pretty well. We had, in the last year for which we have statistics, 2009, there was a single child maltreatment fatality. In 2008, there was none. This contrasts with Texas, for example, which has the highest rate of child maltreatment fatality in the country, but also a tremendous amount of more poverty, many more distressed families that have suffered disadvantage as a result of racial and ethnic disadvantage. And I don't think that the good performance of New Hampshire has to do so much with the social services that we provide poor families in New Hampshire. I think it has to do to a large extent with the situation of economic advantage that obtains in the state.
What do you think, Jim? And then we'll go to our callers.
Well, I don't think I'm too far off from what's been said. My point is that it does, in fact, happen in all socioeconomic groups throughout the country, and there is a myriad of reasons why it happens. Economic stress is, in fact, a major factor, but I don't think we should ever leave the perception that it's only one group of people. That's my point.
Let's go to the phones. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Heidi's waiting in Francistown. Hi, Heidi. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. To some extent, one of your guests has already addressed my point that I wanted to ask about what people thought, or what your guests thought about some of my ideas that I'm very concerned about, and that is that it seems to me that other countries, those that are doing very well in this regard, take better care of their citizens through they put money, they put services, they put laws into safety nets, into education, and everybody has to pay for that. And people don't seem to squawk. And when I look at what's happening right now in Washington, you know, the kinds of fights that are going on about whether very, very wealthy people should pay their fair share, I just wonder if, you know, we aren't sufficiently sympathetic to the needs of all citizens, regardless of what class they're in or so I just wonder what, you know, whether we're just very reluctant to impose regulations on people when those regulations would be enormously helpful and would give people so much security.
Well, it's hard to untangle, certainly. And David, what do you think?
Well, I think that that's a good point. One of the reasons why you have stronger social safety nets in a lot of other European and industrialized countries is that these tend to be smaller countries. There's this sense of social solidarity. People feel like they're all part of one group, and there's more of a sense that the poor are us or the disadvantaged are us. I may know some of them. They may be part of my family. I do think in the United States there's more of a sense that these people are other, that they've somehow I've been successful, why can't they do it? And there isn't that same sense of togetherness.
What about the idea, and I'll ask both of you this, Jim, perhaps you first, because you come from, again, a state government background, the idea that social safety nets are expensive. Look what's happened to Greece. The complaint now about Europe is their economies are falling apart because they've spent too much on social safety nets. What do you think?
Well, social safety nets are, in fact, important, and they are expensive, but not as expensive as trying to remediate a situation that brought about maltreatment in the first place. Research that our organization, Prevent Child Abuse America, has done shows that we spend $104 billion a year to remediate the costs or to deal with the consequences of not preventing abuse and neglect in the first place.
Okay.
That's a big investment of
in
money.
In terms of incarceration and law enforcement.
Exactly.
And
mental health and juvenile child welfare. Yes.
You know, thanks for that call. And it brings up something else in my mind, though. We've talked a lot, gentlemen, about social safety nets, health care, poverty, mental health, and so forth. But, Jim, what do you think? I mean, is there also just a cultural aspect of this? You know, take money off of the equation. Is America a more violent society? Is it a society where people really don't feel comfortable, quote unquote, meddling, where maybe they would in other countries? I'm just wondering, is there a cultural component beyond all the social safety net arguments that you guys have made?
I think that's a very good question, and I do believe that there's an attitude. I'll call it an attitude.
A live and let live.
Yeah, let it live and let live.
Not my business.
Exactly, and that's where, again, I'll reference the family bubble. You know, a good example is, you know, so we're in the mall, and we see an adult doing something that we don't think is inappropriate. But which one of us stops and says something to either break the stressful situation or offer help without stigmatizing, without blaming parents, because, you know, that could have adverse consequences on that child later. But I think that there is a culture of maybe people not wanting to get involved because of that family bubble, but also because they don't know what to do. You know, it amazes me that for over 20 years, our marketing research has indicated that 90% of the American public thinks abuse and neglect is a serious issue. And when I first got into this job and heard that, I said, wow, we got it made. The problem is we are not engaging people and really showing that it's all of our responsibilities to do something. And again, a lesson I learned. There was a pediatrician who was on a child fatality team. Over 14,000 cases over his tenure, he observed and read all the case reports. somebody asked him, was there a common theme? And he says, yes. He didn't even hesitate. He said, yes, there is a common theme. And that common theme is, as I read the a case report, there was the presence of an adult who could have intervened and did nothing.
An aunt, an uncle, a neighbor, a teacher.
Yes, a teacher, whatever.
A pediatrician.
Exactly, exactly.
And why didn't they?
Nobody knows.
David, you know, speaking of cultural components, we all have different views, too, on what constitutes abuse and neglect. And I'm wondering if that's playing a role here, too. You know, your definition of abuse or neglect might be different from mine.
Well, that's absolutely right. And so we come back to the example of the Texas judge beating his 15-year-old daughter. This is something that is considered to be corporal punishment, and corporal punishment is widely accepted by segments of the population and seen as even important in child rearing by some. And the acceptance of corporal punishment is not uniform. There are places in the country where it is much more widely accepted and utilized. For example, the South tends to be more favorable to the usage of corporal punishment. An attitude that violence and corporal punishment is a way of controlling children does lead, in some instances, to tragic outcomes where parents end up really harming their kids.
Right. And again, as I said earlier, a large, large percentage of the children who die at the hands of a caregiver are under 1 year old. So let's take another call, gentlemen. This is Deborah in, Lebanon. Deborah?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Deborah Samaha. I'm the program director for the Injury Prevention Center at Dartmouth. And I just wanted to let people know about a few things that we are doing in New Hampshire to prevent child maltreatment. We are working to pilot a project in New Hampshire called the Period of Purple Crying. We're doing this through an abusive head trauma coalition, and we are piloting this at Dartmouth. This is a primary prevention project, and it addresses what you were talking about earlier, the cultural component of this. When we look at these infants that are abused, the most common trigger to the abusive events was crying.
And
he just
wouldn't
stop. In our culture,
stop.
Crying is considered not normal, bad, et cetera. And if you have a baby with, quote, colic, you're given the perception that there's something wrong with the baby. So this is a new emerging project that the CDC is looking at, and it's also being utilized up in Canada.
Deborah, can you just step away from the program for just a second and give
sure.
us a little bit of the what's going on behind it. So are you saying a lot of this abuse to babies happens because they just won't stop crying and parents just don't know what to do?
They have found that crying, yes, crying is the most common trigger in these abusive events.
Wow.
And that what many people view, they have found that some babies can cry up to as much as 5 and 6 hours a day within the first 3 months of life. And
oh, I believe
still
it.
still be within the normal range.
Right.
Yet in our society, that's not considered normal, and you need to stop the baby from crying. And what they have found is that when people shake babies, such as in what people know as shaken baby syndrome, the reason they do that is because it does stop the crying. So they get reinforcement for doing something like that because they actually can stop their baby from crying. Yet, you know, there's horrible medical consequences for the baby.
Absolutely.
This is a new project that we're doing with several partners in New Hampshire, such as the Children's Trust, the Brain Injury Association. We've got 8 hospitals looking at this right now.
All right. Well, Deborah, let's talk about this issue. And Jim, boy, so many things in terms of little kids, but that is probably a trigger point for a lot of people.
Oh, there's no question about it. I can go back to the experiences I had as a parent of 4 children. and coming home from a stressful job, and especially my youngest daughter, crying and crying, and it takes all the energy in the world to say, calm down, walk away, let the child cry for a second. It's better than doing something stupid. It's tough.
Right. So better education might help that. What do you think, David? Is that being too hopeful or what?
No, the period of purple crying is an excellent program. One clarification I'd like to provide, though, because this isn't really often recognized, more than half of the child maltreatment fatalities occur as a result of neglect, not abuse. These are kids who are not properly supervised and who manage to injure themselves. They're kids who have physical conditions where the parents don't seek help. These are kids who get into, drugs that the parents leave around.
Drown in the bathtub.
This is something that we know a lot less about how to prevent than the physical abuse part. We do know that teaching parents not to hit, not to shake, is helpful in reducing the physical abuse component. The neglect is much more challenging.
Well, let's talk about that, David.
Typically involves conditions that the parents have which make it hard for them to supervise adequately, like substance abuse problems or mental health problems or tremendously burdensome family conditions.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up because, again, the abuse, we've defined it, we've looked at it, we've talked about ways to avoid it or at least recognize that it's coming on. But the neglect is a really tricky area. How do you even define neglect, Jim?
Oh, wow. The neglect comes in so many forms with so many definitions, statutorily. Emotional abuse is being defined throughout the country, physical sexual abuse. I have a feeling David might be able to answer that even better than me, to be quite honest, because it's so, as you say, it's sometimes so nebulous what that means.
Right, and sometimes you hear about these cases and, the parents say, I just didn't know, or I was just gone for a minute, so to speak. Yeah. David, we'll turn to you after a short break and we'll take more phone calls too. Our number for you to join us with your questions, comments, concerns is 1-800-892-6477. So stay with us.
Hi, I'm Doug Cole, president of Cole Gardens in Concord, New Hampshire. Oh, it's great on a busy day at the Garden Center. We'll hear a lot of our customers say, hey, I heard you on NHPR. It's just good to know that our word is getting out and they're hearing it. Yeah, we highly recommend other businesses to underwrite NHPR. We know the word gets out and we know it's a benefit.
To learn more about underwriting, visit the support page on nhpr.org.
For NHPR comes from you, our members, and the attorneys at Orr and Reno Global Vision, New Hampshire Values. Trusted business advisors for entrepreneurs, business owners, and nonprofit corporations, orr-reno.com. And from TransCanada, generating clean electric power in New England from wind, hydro, and natural gas. Serving New England wholesale and large commercial customers, 1-877-MEGAWATT. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're looking at a recent report that places America last among developed countries in preventing child abuse and neglect fatalities. We're looking at what's behind these numbers, and we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And before we go back to the phones, David Finkelhor at UNH, again, we started talking about neglect just before the break. Really hard to define. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, neglect is the failure of parents to perform activities that are considered to be normal parenting activities that result in some harm to the child. And it is somewhat vague. There are different kinds of neglect. There's educational neglect. There's emotional neglect. There's lack of supervision. There's medical neglect, failure to provide for medical care. There's, but the kind that result in child fatalities, children of primarily under the age of four is supervisory neglect, allowing kids to be around dangerous situations and not really making sure that they're protected.
Knives, drugs, going out in the street. Yeah.
Among the main things we really need are other people who can be eyes and ears in the child's environment. Too often, kids are being raised in situations of great isolation more child care, easy to obtain child care, and emergency kinds of respite care for families that have some stressful situations.
I want to put a Granite State spotlight on this issue now and bring into our conversation Maggie Bishop. She's director of the State's Division for Children, Youth, and Families. And Maggie, thanks for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we've been talking about these pretty sobering numbers at the national level. Maggie, where does New Hampshire fit in with this?
In particular, around the child death question that has been talked about, and
right.
I think it was referenced earlier, New Hampshire has had very low numbers. And again, I attribute some of that to the prevention work. But I can't argue with the point around others being the eyes and ears. No agency, no entity could address this issue in isolation.
Where are the biggest gaps, Maggie, do you think, in your opinion?
I think geography is one. I think access to services for some families who are experiencing stress or other kinds of frustration in relation to childbearing or parenting. Having the array of services available to everybody across the state or even across the country, I think is important.
Geography meaning some people are really isolated. They live on a house at the end of the dirt road and there's nobody else around to help.
Exactly. They're isolated and perhaps their access to services could be limited.
What about the decision to remove a child from his or her family for his or her own well-being? You know, we hear, Maggie, about parents saying, the state has unfairly taken my child. And then we hear neighbors saying, no, this parent was abusive and the child needed to be removed. How do you weigh those decisions? Those are huge.
Well, the decision to remove a child is clearly driven by safety. There has to be an imminent safety factor addressing the child. And in New Hampshire, one of the things that I like is the fact that we don't make these decisions, we being DCYF, mm-hmm. in a vacuum. We have the court, we have the family, we have service providers, people involved with the family, like schools and doctors. And then we have CASA, which is another entity that comes in when DCYF does remove a child and goes through the court process. The court provides us an opportunity to really look at the family from various perspectives, and the court gets the perspective from everybody.
CASA being court-appointed special advocate, it's a group
yes.
that assigns a child to a volunteer who helps that child through the court process, since obviously they need help with that.
Correct. And so the system allows for many points of view, many perspectives on what is happening, so that we're not making decisions as serious as removing a child alone. We're making it as a system.
What about cuts to the court system, Maggie? Have you seen an impact yet on your ability to make these tough decisions to protect children?
It hasn't impacted our ability to make the decisions. I think what has happened and is of concern to probably parents is the time, the scheduling of hearings, the ability to commit the time in the court process. But I will say in New Hampshire, we have judges who go the extra mile to make sure that families have that time in court.
What about, you said access to services, Maggie, and I may want to ask our other guests this as well. Some parents are going to be afraid to ask for services. They may feel like, ooh, I'm getting a little out of control here, but I don't want to tell anybody because they might take my kids away.
And that's a genuine concern. And I think part of my role has been over the past several years is to have a different lens that people can see the Child Protection Agency through, that we're more working with families to prevent removal. In fact, that's the last thing we want to do is remove a child, and we'll only do it if we absolutely have no other mechanism for assuring the child's safety. And so the more that the community and parents can see the agency as a partner in helping to keep the child safe, hopefully they'll be less fearful of our involvement. Maggie, that's an uphill challenge. I acknowledge that.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye. That's Maggie Bishop, Director of the State Division for Children, Youth, and Families. And Jim Horovitz, I wonder what you think about that. You know, we say access to mental health care, access to prevention, but I don't know. Maybe if I were doing that, I'd be too afraid to seek help because of the consequences.
Well, if you felt that way, you would feel like a majority of many Americans. Let me put it that way. As I go through the country and talk to parents and listen to parents and folks, one of the biggest issues is exactly what Maggie said, is that parents sometimes feel stigmatized that nothing bad has happened yet. But if they ask for help, will somebody want to take my child away or judge me for that? And I think what we need to do is create a culture in the United States that it takes guts to raise a children. It takes a lot of help to raise a children. And we ought to congratulate parents who say, I don't know what to do right now. I need help. That's what we ought to ask.
So how do you do that?
Well, I think we have to normalize that very attitude, to be quite honest.
That parenting is hard, and sometimes it's not all cheery and, you know, the way it looks on the cover of magazines.
Exactly. And that is going to be a tough job. That is changing an actual social norm, a cultural attitude towards things. But I think we've got to start, because the consequences of not starting now are so great. And I think that what we have to do is to pay attention to the fact that when a parent asks for help, that help needs to be available. I mean, as I go throughout the country, I hear the horror stories about I was told to get services, even by a judge, and it took me 3 months to get in.
Mm.
So I think there's a dual responsibility, letting parents feel that they can get help, and then second, having the help there when it's necessary.
Let's take another call. This is Rob in Ringe. Hi, Rob. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. And one other factor about why it hasn't declined over the last 20 years, the incidence of this, is that the family structure has actually changed. There are a lot, among the 20-somethings said, a lot more men are staying home and doing child care than used to be the case, and women tend to be the primary breadwinners.
Are you saying, Rob, that men are more likely to hit their kids?
No, I think that they haven't been culturally trained to be be caregivers as children.
So go ahead. So finish that thought. So.
Well, my thinking is that they're just not there has been this demographic shift, and so their boys who were in their young 20s are in much more often in a situation where they're the primary caregiver because the mother is at work. And I think that they haven't been socialized to be in that parental role in the same way that the girls probably have.
Yeah, it's interesting. And, you know, I've noticed just in my own life, Rob, you know, when women get together, they do talk about their kids and the trouble they're having. And I asked my husband once, do you and your men friends talk about, you know, the troubles you're having with your kids and all the, you know, issues that come up? No, they say, no, we talked about football. You know, I mean, I'm being really stereotypical, but I don't think men open up to each other as much about the problems they're having. So thanks for the call. David, what do you think? Am I being sexist or am I right?
It's a complicated situation. I would say the caller is right that men are taking greater responsibility. Part of that is a cultural change, though, that men want to be more involved with their children. That's a positive thing. And it is true that there are a group of men who end up in that responsibility, not so much the ones who want to, but who don't have the skills and who need to develop the skills. Because, as Mike Petit pointed out, for example, having an unrelated man in the household is a big risk to a child. But having said that, I'm not sure that I completely agree with the caller, because physical abuse has declined over the last 20 years, actually quite substantially. If you look at the child maltreatment statistics, it's down almost 50% since 1992 through 2009. And I think that means that there are a lot of men who are not abusing children who probably did so beforehand. But this core of child fatalities that hasn't declined, it could be related to men taking greater responsibility. I don't understand why the other indicator would have declined if it was just that.
So just to be crystal clear, David, maltreatment of children has
declined. All maltreatment. Physical abuse.
Physical abuse.
Not declined, but physical abuse and sexual abuse have declined.
Physical abuse and sexual abuse have declined, but it's this fatality rate to child abuse and neglect that we just haven't been able to crack.
In fact, physical and sexual abuse are down in New Hampshire, astonishing, over 60 or 70% since 1992. And it's been a success story that I think has not been sufficiently highlighted, because I think it does say that many of the things that we have been doing, like increasing access to home visitation, early childhood services, and increasing the intensity of our child protection work and the general education about parenting, have been having some effect in the access to mental health services. But this core of very troubled parents and families we are not reaching. They are going to be hard to reach.
What do you think about our caller's point, Jim?
Well, I think David did a nice job of putting context around it, and I agree with him. I'm not going to offer a minority opinion, because everything he said is actual, factual, and this, that, and the other. But, you know, I get a news clipping from the federal government, many of us do, about the news headlines in the press about what's happening in every state. And whereas the data does, in fact, clearly indicate what David said, anecdotally, you know, the articles that are about statewide systems or countywide systems and what are the trends going on right today, not a year ago or 2 years ago, they're startling. I don't know, because I don't have that data in front of me, but I have anecdotal stories that says things are, you know, looking bad for children. So I don't know what the right answer is, to be quite honest.
You mean looking bad for children, that the child, yeah, hold on, David, that the child protection systems are starting to get tattered? Is that what you're saying? Or just anecdotally, it seems like things are getting worse, Jim? What are you saying there?
All of the above, according to the headlines,
uh-huh.
You know. So there's no question about the factualness of what David said. I'm wondering what our next report's going to look like,
gotcha.
I guess is what I'm saying.
Because each report is based on data from a year or two or three ago.
Well,
go ahead, David, for sure. Let's hear from you.
Well, we have data for 2009, which is the first full year of the recession.
Right.
And interestingly, sexual abuse decline and physical abuse was kind of flat, and all total maltreatment was kind of flat for that year. There are some reports now coming in that indicate that abusive head trauma may have been on the increase. But interestingly, the FBI crime reports are now in for 2010, and they show overall decreases in crime and decreases in overall homicide. And as we've looked over the last 20 years, the general physical abuse and sexual abuse rates have fairly well tracked the overall crime indicators. So everyone is somewhat surprised that crime and homicide have not gone up in reaction to the economic stress. I think it's a mixed and complicated picture. It will be interesting to see the data, but I don't think we can assume that the recession has made everything worse.
And there is the idea of child welfare safety nets and so forth, and certainly everything's been cut in states around the country. States are under tremendous pressure. I wonder what you think, though, David. I mean, that's part of the picture, but it's not the whole picture. So will we see a result of this or of these cutbacks or not?
Well, I think some of it depends on how much kind of despair there is.
Economic despair.
Well, just general despair about the direction things are going. And I think that's a very important kind of psychological factor. But to tell you the truth, you know, it's very hard to predict the future. People were really surprised. They expected big increases in crime and violence in the 1990s as a result of some demographic trends that didn't happen. Things often move in directions that surprise us in this area.
Well, and it's good to hear some good news from you, David, that the recession thus far didn't cause this huge increase in, you know, homicides and violence.
Yes. One area that I think we could be doing a much better job in is our development of knowledge about the problem. I'd like to contrast something. The issue about removing children from the home is a very difficult and troubling policy matter that Maggie Bishop talked about, but we really don't have the scientific knowledge to allow her and her colleagues to make this decision. I like to contrast it to the kind of knowledge that physicians have with their high-risk kinds of interventions, like using chemotherapy. They know that that can cause great harm to people, but they know that it can also save them in dire circumstances. We haven't done the kind of research that physicians typically have about high-risk procedures that tell them who it really works for and in what situations to apply it and at what dosage. And there's just, in the public health arena, so much more research to guide decision-making about these difficult decisions that we simply do not have in the child protection area. And I think it's a shame because it's something we could do. We've just not made it a priority.
Well, and Jim, to finish up with you again, you've been traveling around the country trying to raise awareness of child abuse and neglect. What have you learned in your trips from state to state to state about this?
Well, I've learned that 90% of the public does, in fact, believe it's a serious issue, and I believe 90% of the public wants to do something about it. And the purpose of the listening tour is to identify all those good things that are going on and how to build youth development assets and things like that, and to put it into a framework for a national strategy. The United States of America does not have a comprehensive interdisciplinary strategy for the healthy development of our children. There's different components throughout the federal government, but unfortunately, families and children don't come in funding streams. They come as family units, and we need to respect that, and we need to continue to make the investments that are working.
Well, both of you, thank you very much for coming in. I really appreciate
it. Thank you for taking this topic up.
Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer today is Craig Martin. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Ryan Lassard and Karen Goll. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in